At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Tom Standage, the editor of The World Ahead 2022 from The Economist magazine. We're looking at 10 items to anticipate what we will know completely 365, 366 days from now. Tom, a very good day to you. In the fall of 2022, two events, a midterm election in the United States. The president's party historically has not fared well in the first midterm following the win of the White House. At the same time, there will be a choice in the People's Republic of China, the gathering October or November, for the next 5 years. And to my understanding, the general secretary of the party, Xi Jinping, is standing for what will become an unprecedented third term. What do these two events tell us about the world ahead? Good day to you, Tom.
Hello, it's good to be here. Yes, absolutely. I think this rivalry between the US and China, but more broadly between democracy and autocracy, is one of the prisms through which to understand not just the coming year, but in fact the coming couple of decades. And I think this is one of the sort of longer term trends reasserting itself in the wake of the pandemic. And it's going to be a particularly acute contrast in the fall of 2022, because you're going to have democracy in America looking like a bit of a mess. I mean, it looks like a bit of a mess already, but you know, Joe Biden is trying to rally democracies and say, look, we need to make the case for democracy. Democracy needs to do more than just survive. It has to show that it's a better way of delivering prosperity and stability and you know, economic growth and innovation and all those sorts of things. At the moment, it's quite difficult to make a lot of those cases. And you look at somewhere like China, which has been, you know, growing quite rapidly for quite a long time, and does seem to be able to innovate and certainly has a social stability, although at the cost of personal freedom. So, you know, there is going to be this very, very striking contrast between these two ways of doing things, and between the rather messy nature of American democracy, and it has to be said, you know, democracy in other countries too, and this sort of incredibly stage managed ceremony we're going to have. You know, Xi Jinping is practically going to be crowned emperor, in effect. He ought to have named his successor 5 years ago, but didn't. And he's going to be, it looks like, you know, trying to hold on to the reins of power, certainly for the next 10 years and possibly longer than that. So that is going to be a very striking contrast.
I mentioned, because your item sent me to South America, where I've been doing reporting. We have a number of elections imminent in South America, and we have a big one in Brazil next year and in Colombia, two major components of the success or not of South America. And there is a new debate in South America to populism or to market-based economy. So democracy will be on view. We can't settle it now, so let's go to the next pressing matter, pandemic to endemic. What does that mean, Tom, if we make that transition? What does it tell us about where we are now and where we're headed in a year from now?
Well, where we should be a year from now is that the virus becomes one of these diseases, and there are sadly many of them already, that are very dangerous and often deadly in the developing world, but don't pose a dramatic risk to people in the rich world. And there are lots of things like that. So malaria, for example. Malaria is an annoyance in the rich world. It's something you might catch on holiday if you go to some parts of the world, but you can have some pills and it will go away. Malaria kills lots of people in the developing world. And you know, there are many other diseases that fall into these categories. If you have access to good healthcare, then you can essentially stop worrying about lots of them. And the coronavirus should fall into that category for vaccinated people, as well as having better vaccines next year. We're also going to get better therapies. So we've got these new antibody treatments, but most excitingly, we've also got these new antiviral treatments, which will mean that people who do test positive will essentially be given a course of what looks like antibiotics, and you just take take it home and, you know, pop your pills for a week, and that dramatically reduces the likelihood that you'll become seriously ill or die from the coronavirus. And that's going to be a big change next year. We've got these very promising antivirals that are just starting to be approved around the world. And so that will mean that we get to the point, if we're lucky, certainly those of us in the developed world who are vaccinated, where by the end of next year, we have an endemic disease, so like the flu, you know, like other diseases that have been floating around but no longer pose a risk to us. And that should mean that, you know, the disruption that we've seen to our everyday lives in the past 18 months has essentially become a thing of the past.
The puzzle here, is this another one of those occasions of the developed North and the undeveloped South of the world? Or is the division here, pandemic to endemic, based on income and based on wealth? How do you see it, Tom?
It's chiefly actually access to vaccines and take up of vaccines. But that is broadly dependent on wealth. The richer countries have got more of the vaccines. The rollout of vaccines to poorer countries is starting to pick up, and it should make very good progress next year. But there will be, it will largely correlate with wealth. Of course, the other complicating factor is that in some rich countries where vaccines are abundant, a lot of people are refusing to have them. And for those people, the coronavirus will continue to pose a danger. Essentially, everybody is either going to be vaccinated or they're going to catch the virus. It's one or the other. That's how you build up immunity to it. And so if you choose not to be vaccinated, then you are putting yourself in harm's way in a way that is frankly unnecessary.
Supply chain, inflation, it's upon us. The central bankers are hesitating. I note that Andrew Bailey, Bank of England, hesitated recently to raise rates to a surprise of the city. But supply chains as well. We have worries about a shortage of turkeys for our Thanksgiving. Are you worried about turkey for your Christmas, Tom?
Yes, there are very similar headlines here. Obviously, we've got a bit longer to go to Christmas, but there are concerns about, that people are already buying their chickens and freezing them, and there are worries about, you know, are there going to be enough? I mean, we have compounded things. You've got this supply chain crisis around the world, and you've got higher prices for lots of goods, which is driven in part by the fact that people have switched from buying services to buying goods. So instead of spending money on things like holidays and going out and going to restaurants because they haven't been able to, they've switched to buying goods, and that has increased demand for those goods, and that has strained supply chains. Then we've also, as a result of that, got this energy spike. We have compounded all of this in Britain by also leaving the European Union, which means that we got rid of a whole load of the people who used to run a lot of our industries, like hospitality, like fruit picking, and so on. So we have a massive labour shortage there that's even worse than the labour shortages that we're seeing in other parts of the world, where people are reluctant to go back into hospitality jobs because they're worried about catching the virus. So the country we're most worried about when it comes to a sort of 70s style stagflation is Britain, because we're very reliant here on expensive natural gas for our energy, and we have this post-Brexit complication that is making our supply chains more strained and increasing the shortage of labour.
The future of work. Now, Tom, I'm not in an office. What's an office? Could be a question our children are going to ask in about 25 years. The Economist is right now decentralized, not in an office. You note that hybrid work is yet to be defined. Do you see this a year from now still being an open question?
Very much so. I think this is going to take a long time to shake out. So we should both check our privilege here, because we are lucky enough to work in an industry that allows us, you know, journalists have always worked remotely, they've travelled, they filed their copy remotely, etc., etc. About half of the working population in rich countries like Britain and America can work remotely. About half cannot. So this isn't something that the whole kind of world, we're all working from home now. No, we're not. About half of us are, and about half of us are not. That said, this whole debate about the extent to which we continue to work remotely in the future is really interesting, because there is a split between bosses and workers. Broadly, bosses want people to go back into the office some or all of the time. Workers are more reluctant. There's also a split between what workers say they want and what they actually do when given the choice. They say, oh yes, 3 days in the office and 2 days at home, that sounds fine. But if you give them the choice, they actually stay at home nearly all of the time when they have the choice. And the other thing that's particularly worrying about this, not just that this is potentially a source of conflict between bosses and workers, workers. But it's also that this is potentially very unfair. If you look at who wants to go back to the office and who is happier working remotely, it turns out that women are much happier working remotely. It gives them more flexibility over things like childcare. Members of ethnic minorities are also happier to work remotely, maybe because they don't think that the work environment where they in the office is very welcoming. You know, maybe they face discrimination, microaggressions, and so on. So the danger is that if you give people, you say, well, come back to the office if you want to, then you basically get the young white men going back into the office, and then they're the people who, you know, get the visibility with the bosses, they get the promotions, they get the pay rises, and this actually makes the whole world of work much less fair. And this is, you know, a contrast to the sort of Zoomocracy that people were hoping for, where the fact that you can work anywhere in many jobs would mean that you could potentially make a lot of progress on diversity and inclusion. So which way will we go? Will we end up with a fairer, more diverse workplace, or will we end up with a less fair one? We'll start to see next year.
English language is brilliant because it invents words. Here's one. See if you get it right away. Techlash. The new techlash. Tom, what is techlash and what is to be done?
Well, so techlash is actually a word that was coined by one of my colleagues at The Economist in an earlier edition of this annual. So it is the backlash against technology firms. The Economist has a bit of a track record in coining words. Benelux, which is the word that refers to Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, so those are low countries, is another coining from The Economist from about 50 years ago. Anyway, the techlash. There is interesting bipartisan agreement, and there has been for quite some time in the US, that tech firms are bad and deserve to be taken down a peg or two. And this is one of the few things that Republicans and Democrats agree on, although they don't seem to have actually made much progress in doing it. What's really interesting is that after much sort of sound and fury and many lawsuits and many hearings, China has surged into the lead. Xi Jinping has brutally clobbered China's tech firms in 2021. He's used the pandemic as cover to do it. He's wiped $1.5 trillion off their stock market valuation. He's done things like banned children from playing video games during the week. He said that online tutoring companies have to turn themselves into non-profits, and he's also prevented some Chinese companies from doing flotations on American stock markets. He's basically trying to steer Chinese tech firms away from sort of trivial consumer tech, as he sees it, like video games and online shopping, and towards important things like artificial intelligence, quantum computing, robotics, things that will give China a geostrategic advantage. And what I think is quite interesting is that American politicians look at him and think, God, if only we could crack down on Facebook like that. But of course, you can't do that in a democracy. So I think the longer term question here is, to what extent will this work? If Xi Jinping says stop making video games and e-commerce and start focusing on AI, will that actually work? Or will it in fact stifle Chinese innovation and reduce the dynamism of the tech industry? I think it will.
Tom Standage is the editor of The World Ahead 2022. When we come back, crypto. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.